You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us. On today's podcast for the Worldview segment, I discuss the sanctity of life that's coming up Sunday, January 18th. And this week, I'll probably be discussing all different manner of issues related to that. And then for the main topic, I start talking about methods of design and permaculture. And it's actually turned into a two-part podcast. So for today, it will be the first part. For today's worldview segment, I want to talk about the sanctity of life. This coming Sunday, January 18th, is the Sanctity of Life Sunday, observed by the church as the third Sunday in January to mark that time when Roe v. Wade was instituted in 1973. And since that time, perhaps 50 million children have been aborted. And the way that I want to do this is I just want to read to you three paragraphs from R.C. Sproul on a post that he did related to this topic. And really what he's talking about is, you know, some people say, you know, should the church observe Sanctity of Life Sunday? Now, in many churches that I've been in, they've observed Sanctity of Life Sunday. I think it's a good thing. Not that they absolutely have to preach, but my question would be, why aren't you preaching about this, or why aren't you at least acknowledging Sanctity of Life Sunday? That would be my question. So I'm going to read to you just three or four short paragraphs from R.C. Sproul's blog. And I'm kind of starting in the middle, so just bear with me here. He says, "While the choice of December 25th as the anniversary of Jesus' birth is rather dubious, we do know with certainty what happened on January 22nd, 1973. On that day, the Supreme Court handed down its decision in the case Roe v. Wade. The nine men determined that every state had the duty to give women unfettered access to abortion up until the birth of the child. It was a day whose infamy overshadows December 7th, 1941, in the memory of the church in America. Since that time, perhaps 50 million babies have been murdered in the womb with the full protection of the state and the knowledge of the church. Abortion in America is, in the judgment of my very wise father, the greatest evil in our history. The American Holocaust dwarfs the evil of Nazi Germany in both numbers of the dead and the numbers of we who know what is happening. Can we then impose an obligation that every pulpit should speak against the great evil on the third Sunday of every January? Of course not. The pulpit, like the bearers of God's image, is sacred. We cannot rightly impose any obligation not explicitly found in Scripture. We no more ought to impose Sanctity of Life Sunday on the church than we should impose the observance of the birth of Jesus. On the other hand, Sanctity of Life Sunday is a fitting, as sensible, as reasonable as observing the incarnation from the pulpit. Just as we must preach the glory of the incarnation sometime, if not in December, so we must preach the horror of this evil sometime, if not in January. To be silent is to be complicit. It is to tell our children and grandchildren that we are as guilty as those Germans who knew and were silent. Of course, our pews are filled with the guilty. The same is true of every sin we preach against. Of course, the grace of God in Christ trumps even this great evil. But the same Jesus who died for our sins calls on us to suffer the children to come unto him. When we are silent, when we treat abortion as a mere social problem, a mere political issue, we expose our complicity. So preach faithfully. Proclaim not just the sanctity of life, but the holiness of God, whose image the least of these bear. Call for repentance from the pulpit God placed under your care. Preach the same good news that he preached. that the captive are to be set free, that those marching toward death are to be rescued. Preach and take the heat. For Jesus says, such will make you blessed. Walk by faith and preach by faith in season and out of season. For today's main topic, I want to discuss methods of design in permaculture. And as I've discussed before on this podcast, to me, permaculture is a lot of things, but one of the big things that it is design science, especially when applied to your property. So all of the elements of your property form together to create a design that functions, that's beneficial, that achieves its ends, and is also flexible, and so that you can adjust if necessary. So that's what I want to discuss today, some different methods of design, and as you start thinking about your property, what you want to do. And this really applies to homesteading as well, especially when you're starting to talk about stacking functions, doing things without requiring a whole lot of input. We've talked about some basic overall principles here before on permaculture, things like, you know, basically get the most bang for your buck. So the least amount of input for the greatest effect, the greatest change. And so those are all great principles. You know, they have to do with efficiency and effectiveness. And so when we think about methods of design in permaculture, it's to help us put together a plan, really, is what it is. Permaculture design is composed of all the different concepts, techniques, strategies. When you put all these things together, you know, a technique being how you do something, a strategy is not only how you're going to do it, but how you're going to do it over time. So how you're going to implement that. And all those things kind of working together as a whole assembly with a unified purpose. So that design system will integrate all the different elements or components of what you're trying to do to achieve a whole. So it concentrates not on the components themselves, but on the relationships between them. So it's the interactions. So it's not just the components. Yesterday, when I talked about some of the basics of permaculture, I used an example of a chicken. So it's not focusing just on the chicken. It might be that I have to look at all these elements. What are the things that I'm trying to achieve? What's my purpose? Yes, I want eggs from the chicken, but I also need this particular variety of chicken to be able to be a good forager or to be a good mother. A good permaculture design is sustainable. In other words, it can perpetuate itself, and actually it should get better over time, as opposed to depleting, say, the soil or whatever, so that in 10 years it's sterile and now you need to move on. It's a good permaculture design. It will get better with time. They will continue to function with less input. So again, we talked about order and chaos before. Everything does require input to maintain order, but it requires less input if you have laid out good design. So it's critical, especially critical to get your mainframe design down, because all the smaller things can adjust and change as you observe, as you experience things that you weren't expecting on our property. Maybe I was expecting certain areas to be more moist than they really are over time, and so I have to adjust. Okay, those are some of the things that are easier to adjust. It's harder to adjust things like the placement of your house, the design of your house, whether it's passive solar or whatever you're talking about. Those things are hard. It's hard to put in ponds and swales and then change that. Okay, it's hard to put in an access road and go, oh, you know what, that was not really a good idea because I'm getting a whole lot of erosion here, or it's, you know, I've got to work on the road every single year. If I would have done it over here along this ridge line, the maintenance would have been so much less. Those things are harder to change. And so it's really important to get the mainframe design correct first, if at all possible. Now, that is not always possible. A lot of times you might go into a property and there's some what we would call type 1 errors, some errors that the original design, they didn't care about permaculture and they didn't care about this type of design. And a lot of times their house or whatever was not based on what's most efficient or functional. It might have been on the view or, you know, just the assumption of really cheap energy, and so we really don't care about, you know, how it's set up so much. Okay, so this is taking all of the individual elements and then putting together in a functional design, again, to achieve those specific ends. Permaculture design must be flexible. Okay, I kind of alluded to that as you can lay out a design based on various methods that I'm going to cover today, and it might be different when after a time of observation. In fact, it will be different. You will make lots of tweaks left and right, just like anything else. You're going to make some tweaks back and forth. Now, when we say functional and flexible, one of the things that you want to do is that each component that you're looking at in your design should have as many functions as possible. All right, so yesterday I used the chicken as an example over and over again, so I won't do that. I won't continue to do that. Let me use the goat for an example. A goat can have many functions. A goat can be very destructive. A lot of people don't like goats, and they're not the easiest animal to keep. It requires, you know, as they say, good fences, because they will climb and they will jump up on fences, jump over fences. You know, they're tricky, as we found out pretty quick. But they also, if designed properly and seeing how that element, the element of a goat, how it interacts and how it integrates with the rest of your components in that overall design, can be very good and very beneficial. So this is an example of a design system where we take something that could be very self-destructive or which needs a lot of input to support, and then take that same thing and then put it in a way that where it's actually harmonious with the other design elements. So for example, yes, we get milk from our goat. Well, and like I said, a goat could be very destructive, and if we put it in an area with small trees, those trees are toast. I mean, they will girdle them, which means that, you know, they'll get some of the bark around, and I'm talking about kind of smaller trees. They'll girdle them. They'll eat the needles off the trees. I mean, they seem to love ponderosa pine, and especially in lodgepole pine for whatever reason. I mean, they love that stuff. In areas where you want to thin, this is a great thing. In areas where you want those trees to stay is a terrible thing. Okay, so it's how you design that, where you place them, they can be used. So yes, you can get milk from them. You can get meat from a goat. You can get all kinds of different things from a goat. You can also get brush control from a goat. You can get an assist in pruning from a goat. I've heard of people tossing their, you know, their used Christmas trees in with their goats, and they eat up all the needles. They reduce fire hazard. I mean, there's all kinds of things that you can use. There's even businesses out there where people will have, I don't know, anywhere from 20 goats to 100 goats, and they'll be hired by different companies or local governments or whatever to basically do brush control or do, you know, basically get rid of vegetation. And so they'll go down and eat down brush, and whether it's, you know, for to reduce fire hazard or to clear an area, they can greatly assist in those things. And they'll literally come, bring all their goats, put up temporary fencing, and let them go to town in an area, and they can do a lot of good for you. Okay, so that would be an example of multiple functions of a goat and integrating in a system. But at the same time, I've got to be careful because, again, they can be very destructive. I'm not going to let them, you know, have at my fruit and nut trees and those kinds of things. Now, eventually when those fruit and nut trees are bearing fruit and nuts, I have several that are bearing fruit now, but not nearly as much as we have planted. Okay. Now, can I use that? Can I use the excess fruit? And of course. I mean, I can use that for the goats, the chickens, the pigs. Just, I mean, a lot of things. So all these things are working together. We're planting a lot of fruit and nut trees. That's not just for ourselves. Of course, it is. It's not just that we can maybe use some of that to barter. It's not just for the fact that we may end up wanting to sell fruit and nuts in say a market type environment or whatever. But it's also to help feed our animals, okay, in a sustainable way, in a way that requires not that much input, okay? So all of these considerations need to be taken into consideration when you're thinking of design, permaculture design. So flexible, functional, and there's many different ways that you can approach design, and you know, and the combinations of all of these are good too. So I'm going to tell you them up front, and then I'm going to go through each one and take some time with each one. So there's analysis. Okay, so that's, you would be listing out those characteristics or those components. So like I usually think of the goat, listing out what all the goat needs, what are all the inputs the goat needs, and what are all the outputs you get from the goat. Hopefully not just one thing, hopefully multiple things. It's brush control, it's pasture control. You know, you're improving your pasture by running animals on it in a sustainable, managed way. You can get better pasture over time. Okay, as opposed to overgrazing it and it depleting over time. Okay, so that's pasture improvement animal. It's a dairy animal. It's a meat animal. It's brush control. It's a pruning and thinning animal for forest, etc., etc. Okay, so listing out and then all the inputs. What do you need? Okay, you've got to do certain testing before you can get it bred every year. They require, you know, all the various minerals and hay, et cetera, fresh water, all those kinds of things. So you can list out each element you have all the way through, doing the analysis on it and using all the tools that you'd have available to you. Okay, so you're using, maybe you're doing soil testing. Maybe you're doing, you know, you're looking at, There's various resources out there where you can look up the general, of course, every, you know, there's micro changes all over the place, and then various parts of your property, the soil is going to be different, at least slightly different, okay? But you can look at the general overall picture on these resources and tell what kind of soil you have, or what at least is known to be in that area, okay? Whether it's high clay content or loam or, you know, sand or whatever. Okay, so analysis, different ways of doing analysis. Then there's observation. So direct observation of a site. And you can see how a lot of these will end up working together. And then there's the deduction from nature. So that would be designed by adopting lessons from nature. So as we see how nature works, so we observe how certain things grow better in certain places than others, we can mimic that. Okay, it's what Joel Salatin would do with his herbivores. He raises cows on pasture, so he's grass-fed beef, nothing but grass. And he runs chickens behind his cows, like a couple days behind his cows. And he has these different concepts. So he's looking at nature. He goes like, what do herbivores do in nature? You know, what did the herds of the buffalo do? Well, he's broken it down into, well, they moved. So they went through an area. They mowed the area. They mobbed together and they moved. Okay. moving, mowing, and mobbing. So you think of a herd of buffalo moving, mowing, and mobbing over different areas, constantly moving. All right? And then birds naturally come behind all these herds, and they're picking through all of the poop and all that, and getting all the larvae and the bugs and, you know, for food. Okay? And at the same time, they're spreading and scattering all of this manure. Okay? So those kind of, he sees those systems in nature and then mimics them on his farm. So what does he do? He uses electric temporary fencing. He moves, mobs, and mows with his cows. A couple days later, he brings in a bunch of chickens and temporary fencing. They go through constantly a couple days behind the cows. They're picking through the cow patties, eating all the bugs, and providing eggs. Okay, so those are his, what he calls his egg mobiles, and he moves them behind his cows. So that would be an example of design or deduction from nature. So designing from, learning lessons from nature. Okay, there's data overlays. So again, using maps, Google Earth, and using terrain maps, so contour maps, to help do your design and your overlays. All right, and then there's flow diagrams. Okay, so this is real big if you get into like the workplace environment, real big. In any type of manufacturing, this you can go all the way back to, I think it was Frederick Taylor where he would do his analysis to try to find the most efficient. Now I'm not saying his was a good thing, because it was just basically turning humans into machines and saying what is the, you know, if somebody is chopping wood, for example, how do we do it the most efficient way? That's not all bad. That's a good thing. You know, how do we keep from not bending over five times to split one round? Okay. For those of you that split a lot of wood, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Okay. There's ways to do it. You can use tires, you can use bungee cords, etc., to keep from having to bend over to pick back up your round, you know, three or four times to get five or six pieces of wood. Okay. So that's kind of would be an example of a flow diagram, or in an office space, you know, they design all the way down to the desk, the chair, to, you know, where the copier is placed for the most efficient flow to reduce the amount of time people are not working. Okay, so this is applicable to permaculture design as well. When you think of, all right, am I going to put, and in fact, I know a couple of different people who have done, in fact, I know several people who have done this, and it's a great example. They end up putting a garden, for example, somewhere that's totally inconvenient. They got to put it in some weird corner of their property, or they got to, you know, et cetera. I have known several people, almost every time, that they just let it go. It just, out of sight, out of mind, it's overcome by weeds and everything else, and they just said, forget it. Why? Because they didn't have a good flow design. If you have to go out to that garden every single day, multiple times a day, it would make sense to put it in a place that's really efficient. If as a worker had to get up and go to the copier 20 times a day, you wouldn't want to put it on the other side of the building. Okay? So that would be like a flow diagram use for method. As a method of design. And then we have a zone and sector analysis, which I think is great. It's and we'll look at it a little bit more, but it's basically breaking down your areas that you go to in zones based a lot of times on the amount of times you visit. So how often, how much time do you spend there? Okay, so again, it's easy to kind of see where we would set up elements based on how often we visit that place. Or you can think of it like this. The zone analysis is how we expend energy. So how many times do we have to walk out to that garden or to that printer? Okay, you're expending energy that way. So you do it in that manner, and you look at the zones from that perspective. So it is energy out. All right, and then a sector analysis would be energy in. Okay, so that's where does the wind come from? Where is my solar aspect? Where is the, even think about views. Okay, where's the good view? Where's the bad view? All those kinds of things would be applicable to sector analysis. So we have zone analysis, energy out, and sector analysis, energy in. Okay, so the first design method analysis. So you would take all of those components or elements, and then you try and make connections between other elements or components. All right, so this would enable a design component to function. We've got to put it in the right place. All right, so what this is kind of all about is doing that, is listing out all of the inputs and outputs. I mean, there's many ways to do it. That's one way of each component. And then you can figure out where to place them. That's going to best work out and complement each other. So that's what it's all about, is making everything work together. And there's a component that you're trying to gain, and that's self-regulation. Okay, so self-regulation is to place elements or components in such a way that each serves the needs and accepts the products of other elements. So they work together, and they have a tendency to self-regulate. Okay, so in turn for you, that's less inputs, less requirements for you. Okay, so if your animals are taking care of the things that you normally, just in a conventional mindset, would have to mow, that's less input for you. Okay, that's working together, beneficial for all. And so once you do that, once you kind of list out all of the connections between these components, then you want to be able to observe and regulate them. Okay, so just think of it like this. So regulation might involve confining, or you know, building fences or hedges, or it could be insulating if you're trying to do something with water, for example. Whether it's solar water, or you're trying to dig ponds and swales, connect. I mean, there's all kinds of different things. So you want to, like I said before, is that you're going to observe it, you're going to regulate it in whatever way you need to. So this is all things you need to think about up front. Okay. Once all that's achieved, then you can kind of let the system self-regulate, and then you're watching it. Okay. So it's a continuous cycle. Okay, and you just kind of repeat that process as you're looking at the combinations of your elements. Okay, and you're asking yourself some questions. You're saying, okay, what use are the product, or what outputs or inputs of this element component benefit the needs or complement the needs of other components? How can they work together? What needs of this element are supplied by other components? Okay, so your pasture can supply different forage and feed for different animals, and how you would sequence and work those animals together based on lots of different variables. But these are the types of things you're thinking about with design. How about where is this component incompatible with other components? Okay, you're kind of flipping it and not just saying, okay, where would be the best place to put my goat shelter? It's where can't I put my goat shelter? That might be a better question in some cases, or a pig pen, or pig shelter. Not a pig pen. We don't do pig pens per se. Or anything like that. Where do I want to put my my processing shed? Where do I want to put my wood shed? Where do I want to put my, you know, if I require these different types of outbuildings, where do I want to put, my machine shed, etc.? So it all flows together. What makes the most sense? All right. So then when you put all that together, it's going to give you a relative placement plan that's going to start to come together as you start listing all these things out and go, okay, I've got a this annual garden, and I'm going to be in and out of that all day. But I want the beneficial use of chickens to be able to go in there to prep the garden before I plant, and then also to clean it up at the end of the season. So I want that relatively close, and so maybe I design a coop system with some paddocks, some ability to free range, and some ability to easily put them to move them where I want them. Okay, so you know, or maybe you need to, if you have a lot of land, you're going to go with the eggmobile following your herbivores, you know, whatever. Okay, so you're going to start getting these placement plan going as you do this analysis. And we can go into a whole lot more on analysis. There's, you know, you can do an analysis of the property, of the soil, of the water, of the existing area, to include the regulations on what you're going to be able to do, not do. Are you in a property owners association? What are the restrictions in that county, et cetera, analysis. Okay, so, and it applies not just to animals. I've used a lot of animal examples. We're talking structures, land use, like I said, might be regulations. You're doing all of that in order to be able to design. You could come up with just a grand design, but with no permission to do it, or maybe you don't have the water to do it. So you have to think all those things, because water is absolutely, it's a crucial element, probably the most important element in that design. All right, the next method, and again, I hope you're getting a sense that you're not going to pick one method and go, oh, for my design, I will pick the observation method. Okay, you're really using a combination of all of these methods in order to come up with a overall design. Okay, that's what permaculture is all about. It's design science. So you're taking all these methods and putting them together. So observation, this is, you know, as far as design strategy starts at the site. Okay, so it's observing the site. It's walking the site. It's you're doing field observation. You can use map overlays. It's not like you can't use those things. You can't use some analysis tools. Obviously, you can, but observation is a different way of looking at it because you're literally walking the ground to get an idea of how those elements are all going to work together as far as design. So you could take there's a couple different approaches when it comes to observation. There's a thematic approach. Okay, you could say, okay, let me be a drop of water, and where does this water enter the property, and where would it exit the property? What would be the path that it would take? You know, as you stand on each piece of ground, you're like, okay, if water were to fall here, where is it going to drain to? Where are the wet spots? Where are the spots that are really lush that you can tell that's just really moist? Where are your puddles gathering when it rains? I tell you, one of the things I do is I run around here, and I have many times when it starts raining, I'll run outside and start walking around and looking to see where the water's pulling up. I'm looking at the drainage ditches and saying, okay, is the water pulling here? Where is it flowing? At what point does it start flowing down this way, and at what point does it start flowing down that way? Okay, where are things starting to puddle? Where do I need to maybe worry about drainage, or where can I use it as an advantage to collect water? Where are the areas where I can put in cisterns? Can I put in cisterns up high and then use gravity to be able to use that water? Okay, so that would be an observation method, is that you're actually walking the property, you're taking your time, and you're looking at it. You're looking at a single element in a theme like water or energy. You know, how does this home heat itself? That's important to us in northern Idaho. You know, what is the primary method of heat? What is an alternate or a secondary method of heat? How can I improve that? How can I make that more sustainable? How can I reduce the inputs for the greater output? Okay? All right, whether that's through wood stoves or rocket mass heaters or whatever it may be. Okay? Okay, so there's that. There's a thematic approach. There's a non-selective approach. It's just almost like you're just going, okay, I'm just going to walk it and see kind of what comes to my mind. Okay, I wonder why there's moss here. Wonder why there is, even in the driest part of the year, it's still moist here. Why is that? Okay, so it's kind of a non-selective approach or a non-thematic approach. There's an instrumental or instrumentation approach where we might measure, use equipment, factor temperature gradients, wind, reflection from trees. You're looking at composition of soil. You might even look at doing estimations of the trees and like as far as percentages of what you have on the property. It's like, do I have 60% dug fir? Do I have this much cedar? Do I, you know, those kinds of approaches. There's also an experiential approach. Okay, so you're just trying to develop a strategy based on, you know, what your senses are telling you. Okay, this is kind of weird, but you're kind of bringing it all together with this. You're walking the property and you're trying to understand. And like I said, it kind of reminds me of the water. You know, if you just imagine, okay, I am a drop of water. How am I going to flow through this property? Okay, it will tell you a lot to do that. And I remember when I was in flight school learning to fly airplanes and helicopters. And, of course, we had to do all kinds of study, had to understand engines and power plants, you know, all different kinds of power plants and et cetera. And, you don't have to explain exactly, you know, you were a drop of fuel and explain exactly how you would work your way through that entire engine. And that was something that we had to be able to explain. Okay, so this is the same kind of idea, but you're just doing it on a piece of property. One of the observations I've made on our property out here is a potential spring. Okay, so if we think of this in kind of an order or a strategy or design strategy, you know, when I first saw the area, I just saw an area of, there was a lot of moss around it. It was very moist. And it was at a dry period. Okay, so what I decided to do is, okay, I'm going to keep my eye on that area throughout my time here. So when we first came out here, did a site survey, looked at the property last March, I noticed it. And I said, that's interesting to me. Okay, we came out here the next month to close on the property. I looked at it again. It was very, very moist. And the spring here is very wet, so it was actually flowing. It was turned into a seasonal stream. Okay, based on this, tracking it back up to this spot, okay, which is very moist and everything else. And then I was not here. My wife came out here in August, which was the very driest time. And, you know, I told her, I said, go to this spot, go up the hill above our home along this path and look to your right about there. You're going to find an area of that's really mossy. Tell me about it. Go up there and look at it. And she did, and it was still moist. And it was, everything else is pretty dry around here because they don't have any system of ponds or swales or anything. And it just gets dry in this area at that time of year. And it was moist, and it was wet. Now, that seasonal stream was not flowing. It was totally dry. All right, so it kind of confirmed my suspicions that there's indeed a spring in there. Just it's a matter of whether or not it can be developed. So based on all of that experience and observation, I plan on developing a spring there, at least attempting it. And what I'll do is I'll put a cistern up there, which is, it's above our property. So, you know, in elevation, it's probably 20, 30 feet higher than our home site and probably 15 feet higher than our upper food forest. Okay, a couple of terraces where we're going to really plant that out and using guilds and really making a food forest. Well, if I can develop that spring and I can use a very simple pump to fill that cistern, or even use just gravity to fill that cistern, then I can just use gravity to irrigate my food forest for the first couple of years when I might need to. Okay, once the food forest becomes developed and it's doing well, it'll probably need very little irrigation, if any. But that's one example of using observation to do design and linking all of these components. Because that seasonal stream does great things downstream as well. It's going to lead into swales and ponds and other things as well. But here I can use that on the upper portion of the property to link to food forest, to link any excess we'll run into a ditch that runs back into the place where the seasonal stream goes into, will run down into an upper pond that will overflow into a swale that'll overflow into another pond, etc., etc. Okay, so all these things I'm trying to link them to gain the most benefit for the least input. Okay, so what I'm talking about is a very simple thing. I'm not talking about a huge digging wells or putting in massive pumps or anything. If I can, I want to store water up high, use gravity, and be able to use it that way. Okay, so that'd be an example. This would be very much the principle of working with nature instead of against it. So instead of saying, okay, I want corn, so therefore I am going to clear this area and plant corn. That's what I want to do. It would be more the idea of like, okay, let me observe and take a look and see what natural systems are, particularly around here, and see which ones or what grows well. First of all, what is growing well here? Does it lend itself well to a main crop, like corn or whatever? Or does it lend itself better to tree systems? Or does it lend itself really well towards animals? And then what kind of animals? Okay, so this deduction from nature, adopting lessons from nature. So looking around at us. I used the example of what Joel Salatin talks about all the time, herbivores being followed by birds. So he does the whole moving, mobbing, and mowing of cows in managed intensive practices followed by birds as mimicking the natural system of herbivores and birds in nature. So think of, again, the herd of buffalo on the plains, the wildebeest, and the large herds of elk and things like that that move across areas. They move, mob, and mow. They mob up for predator protection, and they mow as they go so they don't stay in one area and overgraze it. And they move, okay, to get to some more ability to mow. And then birds are following them along because there's lots of food for them when they follow them, etc. So that's a natural system mimicked, and that's how he does it. That's how he gets more cow days per acre off of his land. That's why his pasture is better than most farmers. That's why he calls himself a grass farmer. Okay, so he's mimicking those systems. So we can discover a great deal about natural processes in whatever region that you're in. And so we need to look at some of the following in order to help break this down. So if we look at the structure of natural systems, we see things like in my area, we have large coniferous trees, so evergreen trees. And on the edges, whenever you see clearings, you see a lot of herbaceous perennials, so woody shrub type perennials on the edge, ground cover, lots of ground cover there in that area. So that edge between there is very rich. and lots of vegetation. It's like one of the most, vegetative areas is if you go to the edges of clearings and just look around. When you drive by, you see an area where there's a clearing. Take a look at it. It's also where you'll see a lot of birds that are nesting on the edges of these clearings, and they're using the clearings a lot, depending on what type of birds we're talking about. We're talking about predator-type birds, birds of prey. You know, they're nesting themselves on the edges of clearings. They're using those clearings as hunting grounds because it's very productive. Okay, so if we think of that and then we kind of mimic that system in food forests, we can use that type of system where we have layered edges of productive trees, shrubs, ground covers, etc. Okay, so we mimic that system because we know that the edges are productive. So instead of making an orchard with one tree that has 15 feet of space in between it and there's nothing else around it, okay, instead we're using that area in between and almost creating our own edge, our own little productive area. Now, you have to be smart about how you build that, okay, because so obviously these systems in nature work. Right, I'm looking out right now at the edge of my forest, and I can see it. It's shrubby and has woody type shrubs and herbaceous type layers at the edge there. They all obviously do well together because it's everywhere. So you'd have to mimic that by putting together companions that work together. Okay, so that would be a mix, and we'll talk about that at some point. Not today, but when we're designing food forests or designing companion planting type, you have to think that through and see what works well together. And then even to the point of, well, which side of that main tree that's the kind of the center of this guild, you know, I can plant different things. One's going to be a shadier side, one's going to be a sunnier side, etc. Okay, so that would be looking at structure. And then, again, we can improve on that by making what we plant there productive for us. Okay, so instead of just shrubby layers and things like that, which might be great for using as browse for your goats, for example, but maybe you're planting productive bushes, fruit bearing bushes, nitrogen fixing bushes to help all that along, and you're getting different types of productive trees, plants, all the way down to the root layer. Okay, so that, again, we can mimic those systems. We can even encourage birds to nest. You know, you can build birdhouses and attract birds. Why? Because they're good for that system. Okay, and again, you're mimicking nature. A good natural system has all of these elements. And so our systems should have all of these elements. So you're attracting birds. Why? What are they doing? They're doing pest control for you. They're doing rodent control for you. They're spreading seed around. You know, that's how seed a lot of times is spread. So there's lots of things that you can put together here to mimic natural systems. So that would be kind of the structural look. And then, process. So I talked about this before, but how does water flow on your property? How is it absorbed? What trees grow in certain areas when you walk your property? You get asked the questions like, why I have all these conifer trees, all these pine trees everywhere and cedar, but you know, I have all these little bunches of birch, but they only grow in certain areas. Why is that? You know, things like that, those observations. So we see that. It's like, hey, you know what? My hardwoods do really well in these areas. They do well when they're closer to water, for example. So I can mimic those systems. If I want to propagate birch, well, then I set it up that way. Okay, so again, I'm not saying, nope, I want all of this to be an area to graze my cows. So I'm going to cut it all down and graze my cows. Instead, I'm working with nature, not against it. Okay, that would be the principle. Our scripture for today comes from Psalm 3, verses 1 through 3. O Lord, how many are my foes? Many are rising against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God, Selah. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory, and the lifter of my head.
That's the podcast for today. Don't forget to visit us at thecourageouslifepodcast.com. Please leave us some comments and questions. Also, like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast. Thanks for listening. Semper Fidelis and Soli Deo Gloria.